Right, I've had better.
Let's get the show flowing.
Yes.
Right. This is 1003.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Good, that's the best one yet.
I am short.
Pizza, pizza.
Big O! Showtime!
Just swinging in the breeze.
Oh, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no fuddy duddies that'll make it bad. For the stream link, go to like the DLFGS.org. And the IC channel is linuxtech.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 1003 of the Links Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we got Pat.
Happy May.
And we have Joel.
Good evening.
Yeah. Joel, Pat.
Yeah.
So, I think I spoke last week about the project I've been working on, moving us over to Google Secrets from Vault. Are we there for that, Joel?
Yep.
Yeah, you were. So, I ran into a shit ton of problems last week. And it was one failure after another. In that when I went, so there's two parts to this. And the first thing is, well, the main thing is workload identity, which is when we're deploying a container into Google Kubernetes engine or environment, that workload identity allows you to take the Google, like link the Google service account to the container. And that what essentially happens is there is a service account that is responsible for, lack of a better word, deploying the container and creating container in that Kubernetes cluster in GKE. And then the workload identity has essentially another service account involved in that. It kind of injects that service account in, which is known to the cluster and the node pool that that cluster runs under, and links to the service account or a service account in your project. So there's kind of three different service accounts involved here. There's the cluster account. There is the workload identity account, which gets created in the same project as the cluster that links to a service account that is created in the project where the application or whatever it is, all the services that you want to use, exist. And my understanding in reading the documentation for all of this is that at some level it does what's called account service account personation, where it's the container is running as one service account and it injects the impersonated account into the environment and sets it up as the default application, or Google default application credentials. So there is an environmental variable. So Google has recommended when you are running applications that consume Google services, the way that they recommend doing it is through their Google application credentials, and that is kind of like an environment-based implementation. So there's a couple of different ways that you can facilitate that. But largely for our applications, which use our Node application, utilize Google client libraries for Node, they look for an environmental variable called Google Application Credentials. And that is just a simple pointer to where those application credentials file is in the environment. And so the way that we have been using it in the past is that we have been taking the service account key, which we store in Vault, and we pull that out of Vault, drop it somewhere in the environment, depending on where we're doing this. Like, if it's a local development, well, it's essentially the same location for local development or any application container. And that is, it gets written to, like, when the application starts up, it pulls those secrets from Vault. One of them is the application credentials. Drops that JSON object into a file in the same location as the application files, and sets the environmental variable to point to that, so that when the application starts up, that environmental variable is available, looks at credentials, and it can use consume the Google services. Now, workload identity kind of handles that, injecting it into the environment and setting that up for you, so you don't necessarily need to worry about that on the application side. But the second part of this is local development then becomes a tougher nut to crack, because we don't, with the new service accounts that this is going to be running under, we don't have the service account credentials. So there isn't an application or service account key object that is given to us. It's not needed anymore. So it was, the second part was, what are we going to do for local development? And theoretically, there is the ability to impersonate an account locally. And that's what Google recommends that you do. You take advantage of the application default credentials. So they have a command line tool called gcloud. And gcloud is what you use to interact, or it's one of the ways that you can interact with Google services, Google APIs, and it's primarily the way that you authenticate yourself to Google services. So on the command line, if I wanted to authenticate myself to the cloud, I would just type in gcloud config auth, or I'm sorry, gcloud auth login, and that would ask me what my credentials are. It opens up a web browser and points it to the Google login. So the account impersonation is similar to that. It's a gcloud auth login, or gcloud auth login application default. And then you have a switch in there that allows you to say account, impersonate account, and you pass it the email address of the account that you want to impersonate. You have to have the permissions to do that, though, and that's sort of IAM permissions you can set up. So you basically tell it, and what it does is, if it's your account, it creates a token under an OS X in Linux. It's under .config gcloud in your home directory, application default credentials is the name of, I believe, the name of the file. And then if you set an environmental variable, Google application credentials, to point to that file, theoretically, when you run your application, it should, so long as you have the right permissions to access the services that the application needs to access, you can run it. And I spent a good portion of last week failing to have this happen. Because what was really annoying is that account impersonation worked just fine. And when I went to run our application I was working on, it's a very simple one. So two things I need to connect. Actually, it's not very simple. But this application mainly, two things it needed to be connected to. One was Google Secrets engine so that I could pull the secrets that we have up there now. And the second one was accessing Google Storage. And what was happening was, under my account, it worked just fine. It could access the storage, it could access the secrets, everything was working just great. We're in bliss. But when I went to go use the account impersonation, it was failing all over the place. Like, it kept telling me the credentials were wrong. It was looking for, it was kind of expecting the credentials in the JSON object that we used to use, which has the client email and the private key and stuff like that in there. So it was looking for those fields, which do not exist when you're impersonating the account. And they do not exist when you set up the application default credentials. So and the weird thing is that my credentials that get set and the impersonated credentials that get set were not that much different. So my credentials work, but not the impersonated credential. So I spent like 2 days banging my head against the wall on this thing, trying to set up, look at all these different things, and theoretically it was supposed to work. So I went off, and we have support through Google Premium support, and then we have a Slack channel set up where we can initialize support with them. And I hit them up about it. They're like, okay, give us some time to look into this. We'll get back to you early next week. Early next week comes, and I'm digging it into it still, trying to figure out why it won't work. And I'm going back and forth with them a little bit, like explaining all the things that I'm doing. So I'm checking out the Google library, the auth library. I'm running test scripts in there, and I'm like, the weird thing is that my account works, but even the impersonated account, it doesn't work in the auth libraries, the examples that they're showing. And I'm like, why aren't these things working? It doesn't make sense. And as I got closer and closer to the solution, I was hitting that up. I was looking in the repos, in the issues listed. And what had happened was, we got up to the point with the Google support, we're like, can you open a support ticket and describe this? And I had gone through a whole bunch of different things here. And right as we're talking about this, and they're like, you know, and I'm like, well, what do I open the ticket as? Because I'm looking at all these, I have to set it as, like, what is the product that you're having a problem with? And I'm like, well, it's none of these things. It's like the client libraries, I think. It's not GCP. And the support that we have in that Slack channel was for GCP primarily. And I'm going through there and I'm like, well, this, I think the problem isn't with gCloud and account impersonation. Your problem is with the application libraries. And wouldn't you know it? Like, as I'm talking about this, I'm getting ready to put in this service account. Like, I'm over on the Google Storage client, Node.js library, and I'm looking through the issues in that GitHub repository, and I found two things about account impersonation. And it just so happened that the one issue that was close to what the problem I was having linked to another issue that was exactly the problem I was having. And the person who was asking the question was about, oh God, a couple months ago, I think it was. And the second person that followed up that said, yeah, we're having a similar issue, and provided a fantastic code example that was really easy to use and replicate in our environment just happened to be a coworker of mine that is on another team. But we had been talking about this stuff a few weeks ago before I started delving into it. And idiot, as I was looking through this and reading it, I realized the problem I am having is because I'm not using the latest library version. So I was still on the library version for a Google Storage client that was, I think, a year and a half, 2 years old. And when I switched to the latest library, work like a charm, Joel. Work like a freaking charm. And so that was really cool, right? And I got some egg on my face. We got it working. That's something I should have realized beforehand. And even one of the articles that I read and was working from had said, you really should be using the latest client libraries. Now, I was under the impression that the latest client library that I needed to use was the Google Auth library, which I had the latest installed. But here's the thing. When you're dealing with Node applications, right, and building Node application libraries, when you're using different libraries, the dependency mixture in there can get really wonky. So when you're building a Node application, you have like a package JSON file, and in there you list your library dependencies that you have in there. And in that dependency list, you can pin versions, you can do some different types of loose pinning to say, use the 1.x branch, and you can do minor versions or patch releases, but you have to stick with this 1.x, whatever. You can do all those different things, or you can just say use the latest and just throw caution to the wind. So even though I had installed the latest Google Authentication library, the version of the Google Storage client library that we were using installed the Google an earlier version of the Google Authentication library, and so that wasn't the right version that supported with the storage client that was able to support application default credentials when they're impersonating. So I upped the version of Google Storage client and it worked great. The one thing that really concerned me about this application was those two things were easy. The secrets and the storage client were easy. The other thing that I had done months ago was implemented tracing and metrics. And that was a whole other animal. Now, are tracing and metrics working properly? I hope so. I probably won't know till I actually get it deployed in the Kubernetes environment. Because trying to filter out my local machine that's putting in the tracing metrics into Google and the development environment might have been a little difficult. So that's one thing I need to look into. And I'm crossing my fingers and hoping that I don't need to update that stuff, because that was a nightmare to get going. I tried to update it, the libraries in there, and something's broken in it. And my Node skills for working today just were not sussing out what that problem was. It was a pain in the ass. But once I had the account impersonation working, I altered our Helm scripts to support workload identity and deployed it into our GKE cluster and development environment. And it worked perfectly there too. I had to build the container first to set up the Quay with all that stuff in it. And it worked great. So I was really thrilled, Joel. It was working great.
Cool.
But that's the thing. I spent 3 or 4 days banging my head against the wall, and all I needed to do was just update the plan. And that, man, talk about that. That's another problem that I find with Node applications is that when you get it working and all the libraries that you need installed and working properly, if you need to upgrade or update those libraries, and there's many reasons why you want to update those libraries, bug fixes, security issues, take advantage of new features, you also end up in situations where you're fighting with breaking changes, where now something significant has been changed and now you need to fix your code, and it can get to be a dependency nightmare. There's also that issue. Like back in the day, RPM hell, remember that? Where you would try to update something and it would say, well, I can't update this because it depends on that. And something else depends on that version and this one's this version. Node has that all the time. Like you change one library and then that might break like three other libraries that are being installed because they require this version and this one requires that version of the same dependency. And it could get pretty twisted. So it's always a pain in the ass, I think, when you're trying to update a Node application like that. Anyway, it is pretty cool. Three things I need to do. Obviously, I need to get this set up in our staging and production environment. The big thing that's holding me back is, for some reason, we'll keep running into permissions issues when we're trying to set this up. Because we do everything like this type of stuff, setting up the services in GCP, accounts, services, permissions, all that stuff is done in Terraform, which we then apply that Terraform to Scalar. And I'm running into permissions issues where I try to apply that Terraform in Scalar and it tells me, we don't have the permissions to do that. Our team and however it's set up and the people that are in charge of it are having a hard time figuring out what it is that they need to do, that they need to provide to us. So that we do have permissions. So they fudged it through for development and it looks, and I thought that maybe they would add a fix for staging and production, but it didn't work when I tried to get it pushed out to staging today. So my speculation is whatever I have, it's up to them now at this point to fix that problem. Once it gets fixed in staging and production, and I'm crossing my fingers that this is a one-time thing in all these environments, I can get the counts created, the workload I then created up there, get that pushed out. Then I can, I've updated all the infrastructure on our side and our CI is ready to go to use the GitHub Actions to deploy it with the workload identity. And hopefully if all that runs smoothly, the third thing I want to do is test out the possibility of us using that workload identity service account that's created as an impersonated account. Because right now, what I'm doing is all these applications, the majority of the applications, I'm going to say all of our applications at this point right now, since we don't have a new application that's going to be set up that I'm aware of in the next week or two, but all the applications already are running and deployable in the environments and have service accounts created for them, but they're not workload identity enabled. So we're using the service account that we already have for that application and impersonating it with that account to run the application. Ideally, I'm hoping that I can impersonate that workload identity account, which is, as far as I can tell, created in our project. And if I can do that, then we could use the same account locally that we're using in the container, and that would make me feel a whole lot better. That we're doing the right thing.
Right.
And because that's always the risk is if you have two, if you're using two different service accounts, technically I should say we're using three different service accounts already. There's one in development, one in production, and one in staging. But when we're doing local development, we're using the same service account that we have in development that we locally. So I would like to keep it like that if possible, because if you mess something up and don't provide the right permissions to the one service account that you do to the other, you could be banging your head against the wall trying to figure out why something's not working. And it should be pretty obvious that in the logs for the application should tell you that you don't have permissions and give you a good idea of where to look to find the solution to that problem. But I would rather use the same service account in development when we're running locally too. That would make me happy. But anyway, that's been pretty cool. I still consider myself a terrible Node developer. I get really, really caught up on synchronous processing, because JavaScript is a synchronous programming language, and that, I guess Java is too, isn't it, Pat? Pat Dye.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Java. Java is synchronous, right? It's not.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think, is C synchronous? See, it's, I'm not used to, I'm used to doing like Python and Bash, and I've done Ruby and stuff like that, and Perl, and so it's easy to do a loop and things like that, but in JavaScript, if you're not careful and you fire off trying to do something in a loop, it goes off and it starts processing within that loop and then continues on with the rest of the script, and you end up not getting what you want to get because it's still processing the loop when it's gone through the rest of the script and finished, and therefore it errors out somewhere because it's not getting values because it's moved on from that while it's in parallel going through the loop. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Fun stuff. Fun stuff, Joel. We are out of vault for that one application almost. Yes. Yes, and we retired two other applications today. That is going to save us around $551 a month. And I think that is something. It's a little drop in the bucket, comparatively speaking. Running this shit in the cloud is not cheap.
No, it's not.
I look like we have our we can look at the costs on a monthly basis, and one of the things that really kind of dropped our jaw when we really delved into this is like our Couchbase cluster, all of our clusters together, I think are costing us close to $6,000 a month, maybe more. Somewhere
around
that.
Oh, that's chump change.
What do you mean chump change?
Well, you got to remember, we have over 100 clients in AWS.
Yeah, so, but what I'm saying
so we have a little more.
Yeah, but what I'm saying I'll tell you, you're right, that, you know, that's like 1% of our total cost that we're seeing in some of these, not even 1%. Right. But like the Google Spanner that we have running just for our planning one application that we noticed is costing us like $7,500 a month for that application. And we're about ready to retire it. So, you know, collecting all that together, you start, you know, $551 might not sound like a lot, but you take that into consideration with the Spanner and a bunch of the other things that we're trying to retire, and moving out of other services, and you start getting into like tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases of cost that you're saving. And that's a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
So now when you talk about you have hundreds of clients and your cost is really high, but the cost goes off onto the customer.
The customer, correct. Yeah. Yeah, some of that does. Plus, we have a lot, some significant things in S3. You know, like log backups and stuff like that go in S3, you know.
Yeah.
And they're doing lots of, they're starting to do a lot of, like when some of the integrations just need like a file export, we're starting to do stuff with S3 for that. You know, most of that's not my team. We support the application itself, but here's like kind of one thing we're trying to track. Client was having like issues with, they were basically busing high school students on campus, and then they were registering for college level classes, like in a lab or something on campus, and for like a period of, I'd say 15 to 30 minutes, the application would be really slow or not work at all. You know, I don't know if it's Node or what it is, whatever's driving the little spinner, you know, that's what would happen, is it would spin when you go from one screen to the next. All right. So I went through, we did a lot of tuning on it. We had them tune listeners. We split the load across two different pairs of listeners. Still wasn't getting better. And this is like a daily thing. So we were talking with the client almost every day. And then all of a sudden, I log into one of their API boxes. And we have this thing where like once a day, for most clients, it will run a warm-up script for the .NET-based API, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I go into task, we run that out of Task Manager in Windows, right? So I go into Task Manager, and then I noticed on the first API server, there's two ways you can run the warm-up. One will bounce the application pulls and then warm it up, and then the next is just warming it up. And I noticed they had just a warm-up scheduled at the exact same freaking time that they were getting the performance problem. And I'm like, So I go and disabled that, and then Monday they go through, didn't have a problem, but then they only had three students register. So I'm like, next week I think they're supposed to have, it's not next week. Oh, no, it's the week I go on vacation. they don't have anything more in that particular time period than, I think it's 16th, 17th is the next time they have that. So, and then it's back to normal. But what was even weirder, though, is even though they were seeing it, we weren't. We'd access the site from our laptops, and it would just, like, you were talking sub-second for doing a course search, which is really, really good. Yeah, you click on, like, the word English, and then it will pull up all the English classes, like, in a second, less than a second. So it's like, I can't make it any faster. So, but I think we might have resolved it. Put it this way, I closed a ticket, so I actually, that one, and then we had another one where a lot of people, and especially in like a higher ed setting, you know, there's a lot of people who use Azure or ADFS. And I had one client a while ago, it switched from ADFS to Azure, and they wanted to set up MFA. The only problem with that is MFA, we really can't, the user we use for validating whether the environment's up through Datadog,
right,
can't use MFA. All right. At least the way Azure configures MFA, you might be able to, if you have like all the pieces parts, like if we own the domain controller that they use and all that, but we don't, it's the on-prem controller, you know, so, and other things. So we don't have any access administratively into their Azure. So they finally fixed that today. And I did have to go in and adjust the synthetic tests. That's what we use, the synthetic testing module in Datadog. And basically that's just like logging into the website, doing stuff, and then logging out. So, but got that all figured out. So that kind of closed. I currently, last day or so, it's been kind of boring, which is good. We go through those moments, you know. It's either we're up to our asses in alligators like it was last week, or this week, you know, lots of little things come in. So, but we use HashiCorp Vault, but I think the big reason we use it is because there's still that front end that we can use, that we can go in and get the passwords and stuff ourselves. But
yeah, don't get me wrong, I like Vault. Vault works great, and I like the structure of Vault.
Well, the structure is whatever you set it to be, so.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty flexible. Yeah.
But like what I was saying with like Google Secrets last week, it's just a flat system. There's no structure. There's no hierarchy.
No folders, no nothing.
Yeah,
right.
There's no like way to do hierarchy in there. It's just all at one level.
Right.
Which is different than what we're used to doing.
In Vault, the hard thing is that if you're writing automation through Ansible or something like that, you need to make sure that all of the clients in our Vault, or in our cases, folders in the Vault, have the same structure. You know, so they might have different passwords, different usernames, but they have to have the same structure in order for the automation to be able to find the passwords. Wow. So that's kind of a problem, because you can easily change the structure in HashiCorp Vault, at least even with our default passwords and stuff, we had the power to change them. So, yeah, and a lot of times, too, those are passwords are not necessary. Like, for example, that synthetic user I just talked about, that is a password that the client actually has, all right? We are gradually switching it over to the where our main administrative password the client doesn't have, right? But the synthetic test user is always going to be one that's set to the client's IDP, right? So that's one that we have to be able to update it when the client updates it, or if we update it as part of a project or something, you know. Mm-hmm. So you know that. That's just some of the weird oddities we get with HashiCorp Vault, and it's not that weird when you really think about it. It's just a fact of that's how you have to manage it. Probably my biggest complaint with the Vault is I can't go in to a folder, like I can't go into a client's folder and search for a username and find the username and the password the way we have it set up. I have to know the structure of the Vault in order to find it. And for someone who basically, like, I know there's some people, like, with a laptop, they'll click an icon and they'll hunt for the icon they're looking for the application they run. I never do that. Not on a Mac, not on a Windows machine. I just press the meta key or the Windows key and start typing, and then search for the application I want to launch. You know? So if you're used to that kind of a methodology, when you go in HashiCorp Vault, you have to go back to the way you used to go find apps in Windows, you know, you got to know the structure. So, yeah, sometimes it takes you a little bit to find the password, especially because not all of our clients are as consistent as we'd like them to be structure-wise there. But we're also, like, the last few weeks we've been going through, like, a little bit at a time, how we're going to start supporting some SaaS stuff starting next week. And so we went through on how to set up an SSH tunnel so that we can set the SSH tunnel up through the corporate VPN, which also happens to be a different one that Managed Cloud uses. And then run pgAdmin to access the read-only database in AuroraDB, which is Postgres. So, but that was interesting. And then, like, for printing, like, they actually send them a executable that they set up on a server somewhere on-prem, and that's how they get all the print back and forth between colleague and the on-prem printers. A little bit easier than setting up printing on-prem in Managed Cloud. Similar thing with LDAP integrations, because our application, you can push a student, like you go in and create a student in the application. You can also have it generate the username password that gets pushed to Active Directory or whatever the LDAP is. It could be Active Directory, it could be Open LDAP, it could be eDirectory, perish the thought. but one of those. And instead of doing it kind of the way we do it, they also have an executable that they give the client set up to help set up the secure connections with back and forth. So there's little differences here and there. We're going to probably be doing a lot less of the kind of things that we do for Managed Cloud. Like, for example, any of the Datadog monitors and stuff, we won't get tickets from. So it'll be like the only things that we'll actually answer are if a client puts in a case. So a little bit easier than the Managed Cloud side. But so that's been my work stuff. And I finally broke down and bought a Pixel Watch, which is Google's version of an Android Wear watch. And so far, I'm really liking it. As always with the smartwatch, I wish that the battery life was longer. It, like, if I go to bed with it charged up, see, the biggest thing is that I like, one of the things I like about it is it does sleep tracking, because it uses Fitbit, Google bought Fitbit, and that's the only thing the Pixel Watch uses. I don't even think it'll send stuff up to Google Fit. But you get like a free 6-month trial of Fitbit Premium with it, which is interesting. I like it so far. It's like after that, it's like $10 a month. I'll probably continue to pay that. But the only thing it doesn't have that I wish it did have is it doesn't have the blood oxygen sensors on the watch. So I missed that. The Wise Watch at least had that, but the Wise Watch didn't have notifications and didn't have a whole bunch of things that this watch does have. And one nice thing I like about it is if you've been sitting there working for a while, it'll nag you and say, hey, you got in this hour, you got to do 250 more steps. So I'll get up, walk downstairs, go walk around the downstairs for a little bit, go upstairs, and that's usually enough. So it tries to keep me active, which is a good thing. And I really like the styling of it. It does have thicker bezels than most of us would like, but I think it works because I usually use a darker the back of the face that I chose is black. So I really don't notice the bezels because of that. So it does really good for tracking like just steps and stuff. But I tried to track a run on a fast walk on a treadmill, and it doesn't really work for that at all. So the best thing I could do on that is do the exercise on the treadmill, and then when I get to the end of my session on the treadmill, just go into the app and punch the exercise into the Fitbit app, and then also adds the steps for that as well. So, it has other things in it too. Like it'll ask you like, well, are you calm? You know, are you under any stress or anything like that? And you can answer that question throughout the day, and it keeps track of that. So helps to keep your stress lower. As mindful thinking kind of things, like little videos that walks you through breathing exercises and stuff like that. I think those are useful. Kind of talks you through meditations and stuff. I do meditate, but it's not, you know, the way they have you walk through it, you know. It's still not a bad thing. The breathing exercises are pretty good. And the food logging. I've used Fitbit before, and food logging has always been, well, really most of the fitness apps I've tried, that is always a mixed bag. Fitbit, like some of the others, you can scan the barcode. Like if you ate like a, I've been picking up a Life Cuisine for lunch, which it's a microwavable thing, but it's a little healthier. Sometimes when you scan the barcodes on some of the food you get, it may not be in their database. So you got to plug the data in anyway. So I have not found a app that I like for tracking what I eat. But the rest of it's pretty good. The apps run pretty well on it. I'm trying to think of any specific apps that I use. The messaging, like I have set text messaging messages via the watch. It'll also do the OKG thing. It's an Android Wear watch without almost every aspect except for it uses Fitbit instead of Google Fit. So if you've ever seen Android Wear before or Wear OS before, you really have seen this. It's very, 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 very similar. So I'm glad I bought it. So
how much was it?
$399. I think $399 or $349. I think mine was $349 because I don't have the. You can get one that has a, you know, they can put a SIM card in it.
Right.
I didn't get that one. I figured I'm gonna have my phone with me anyway. 90% of the time when I'm wearing it, you know. It is nice though. Like if you're someplace like say you're sitting for dinner, and somebody sends you a text message. You can look at it in the watch and see, do I need to pull the phone out and reply to this, or do I continue to enjoy dinner with my family?
On that smartwatch, like, what can you use it? Like, can you do anything without a phone other than without a phone?
That's a good question. It does have Wi-Fi built into it, so I suppose if you didn't have your phone, like if I had my phone upstairs, I could just use the Wi-Fi connection since Bluetooth probably wouldn't work. And that seems to be okay. You know, I've never, you know, like, left my phone at home and just went somewhere, like, on a walk or something, just wearing the watch yet. So, I know the ones that have the, you know, the 4G connection in it, you know, you don't need to have the phone nearby. You still need a phone to have it set up, though. So, because it uses the watch app.
I guess what I'm saying is, you're not going to, like, the only way you could listen to music or do anything like that is if it's linked to your phone. Right?
Mostly, yeah. Now, if, like, a good, one kind of nifty thing you can do is you can make phone calls via the watch, but your phone could be across the, you know, as long as it's within Bluetooth range of your phone, you can literally do all the talking through your watch. It does have a speaker on it, but not what you'd really like, I'll say. You know, I would not like taking a phone call via the watch. Now, text messaging, that's easy. You know, I've sent them via the watch. That way I don't have to pick up my phone. Another kind of example of that is when I'm in the car and I've got Android Wear and the wife texts me, the car can read me the message and I can reply back using my voice, which is very handy. Especially since in Ohio, if you come out to Ohio Linux Fest, Dan, don't make sure you don't futz with your phone when you're driving. They literally can pull you over for that now.
Well, I thought they could do that for a while now.
In Ohio, it was they wouldn't be able to pull you over specifically for that, but you would get a fine if you did something else. So, like, you say you were speeding, and they caught you futzing with the phone at the time they pulled you over, then you can get cited for that. Mm-hmm. Now they can just purposely, like, if they see you sitting at a light, dinking around on your phone, they can pull you over and ticket you. So, I think maximum is, like, $500. So, keep the phone out of your hand, or at least make sure nobody can see it, right?
Yeah, you know what? That's a good idea. You shouldn't be doing that anyway when you're driving. It's dangerous.
True, but
next thing, they'll be coming after you for using your watch, Joe.
Yeah. Well, that's like, now I ordered an adapter. Ham radio has always had an exemption for that kind of stuff. Technically, the FCC regulates ham radio, so most states won't ticket you if you are talking on your 2 meter as you're driving. So, I got an adapter so I can bring my radio in the car. I have a mag mount with a 2 meter, 70 centimeter antenna on it. So I'll probably put that on when I drive out to York. Now, remember when I stayed in the hotel, Dan, for 60 days, right? When we were waiting for the house to be built?
Yeah.
That's how I'm paying for my hotel. 3 days are free. Because I'm staying at another Candlewood, actually. But this time in York. That's nice. I don't have to pay for it. I'm trying to convince the fam. I want to go on vacation. I was kind of shooting around some ideas. Like, one of my ideas was go to Virginia Beach.
Right.
Another was to go into Mammoth Cave, which is a little closer than Virginia Beach. Not much, really, because it's about 4 or 5 hours. between here and Bowling Green, Kentucky, which it's that's about where the cave is. But I think we're probably going to end up. Ohio has several, like, they call it a lodge, but essentially it really is a hotel right on the state park property. There's one at Hocking Hills. There's one at Deer Creek, which is a little closer to us. I think that's the Deer Creek one we're probably going to look at, I think, as our family vacation. The kind of nice thing, it's got two pools, one indoor, one outdoor. It's also got a beach at the lake that's at the state park, and all the trails and fishing and boating and stuff you can do. Better than staying in a cabin because I don't have to cook.
Is your phone waterproof?
I don't know if the Pixel 6 Pro is waterproof.
Your watch. Is the watch waterproof?
Oh, the watch. That's a good question. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be fine like for splashes. I wouldn't with it. I think if you want a smartwatch that has that, I would probably look at the Garmin's. Those probably are. But I didn't know... some of the Apple Watches are too. So the only thing about Apple Watch, you have to have an iPhone. So you can't. The crazy thing is, you can't even set up your Apple Watch if you have an iPad. You have to have an iPhone. So that's why I didn't look at the Apple Watches. There is one thing, though, that Apple's working on that would make me completely switch. And the one thing they've been working on is blood glucose monitoring via the watch. I'd definitely do that.
Now, your phone, your watch, does it only pair with Android, or will it also pair with...
I think it'll do with iOS. I don't know. I wouldn't pair it with my work phone, which is an iPhone, but I know like Wear OS does have an app, but I don't know if the Pixel Watch does specifically, because you don't use the Pixel Watch. You don't use the same app that you would use with any Wear OS watch. It's got its own app, but it's pretty much the same thing. It's just its own app. Plus, you for the fitness tracker, you have to use Fitbit. But I will say one thing. The one nice thing, even though the battery doesn't last as long, it doesn't take that long to charge up. Like right now, when I got back from church, it was at 50%. Because I... What I usually end up doing, my normal daily with the watch is, before I go to bed, I'll make sure it's 100%. That way I use it for the sleep tracking. And then by the time I finish at the gym in the morning, the watch is down to about 50%. So as I sit there and work in the morning, I'll throw it on the charger. I may wait until it's like down closer to 30% before I do that, but if I throw it on earlier when it's only around 50%, which is usually what it is after a night's sleep and a workout at the gym, I could put it on and then maybe as I'm eating dinner put it on again. If I'm just sitting for like on the couch or something, resting after work or something, I can throw it on the charger and then top it off, and then I'll be good till next day. So, but from 50%, it takes about an hour to charge up, which is not horrible. And a whole lot faster than my wife's watch.
Wait, how much was the Wise Watch? Wasn't that like...
$30.
$30. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
You know, it better be a lot better than the Wise Watch for...
charging.
10 times the price.
Right. You could do more on it as well. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's... I also think it's better built, too, than the Wise Watch. And I can get bands fairly cheaply. I now just have the active band that came with it. But I'm considering getting a metal one. I can get one of those for about $16. And that's not necessarily a Google branded band. That's just what I searched, plugged it in, and plugged in Pixel Watch bands, and that was one of the bands that came up. So there are other companies making bands for this other than Google.
Like, they come with a band?
Yes.
Is it a crappy band or what?
It's one of those silicone bands, you know. I will say this because doesn't seem to be as reactive with my wrist as my Wise Watch. That one, I'll probably... I don't know if it's because I wear it more or not, but I'll get like red right around where the watch band is. I always have had issues with pretty much any watch where I get dry skin under where the watch is, you know. But the worst part on the Wise was the redness, and it would get itchy too. This end, even though it's still kind of made out of a similar material, doesn't seem to react with my wrist, so it's not horrible. Plus, I like how it tail end of the band, instead of like a keeper to keep that to stick it in the keeper on the band, the way it's designed is it kind of folds underneath the band, so it actually the little tail end of the band you never feel when you have the watch on. Which is really nice. I like that style. But I might get like a metal band. Metal bands have a lot less problems with than this plastic silicone band. But this one, for a silicone band, my wrist looks pretty decent. I'm not wearing it right now. I got it on a charger now. I might see if I can't grab another charger. The charger itself is proprietary. Doesn't use Qi charging. Wish it did. But it's USB-C. So right now, I guess just got the cable plugged into my MacBook on one of its ports. I have like those Anker USB-C blocks, you know, those like 19 dollar chargers. Those work with it as well. So, but I might see if I can't get another charger for it, so I can have one upstairs from downstairs. So
that's
always
annoying. Why can't it be USB-C?
Well, yeah. Well, I think it's because it does have a little bit of water resistance in it. And if it had like a USB-C, like a hole for USB-C.
Oh, so
Watch itself, it's magnetic. It's
okay. So it does that.
Inductive charger. Yeah, it's an inductive charger. So, but the charger itself is USB-C.
How much is a charger?
That's a good question. Let me look.
Too much money. It's free.
Let's see if I can see it on Google's website. I know rumor has it that Google's bringing out a folding phone.
Okay.
Well. Which I'm not convinced. You know, I like the idea, but I'm not going to buy a phone where I see a crease in the screen. That's just horrible. Let's see. Where's the accessories here?
How well does it tell time?
Oh, perfect. Just as good as your phone. Let's see, Google's bands are right around $60. I won't be ordering a Google band for my watch.
Can you use any watch band on that thing?
Technically, you can and you can't. I think you can buy like an adapter so that you can. Because it's got a really weird kind of connection to the watch itself. Let's see. Charger's $30. I've seen worse. Yeah, I've seen worse. I've seen worse. I like it better than, like, this one. It's just the whole watch sits on top of the charger. The Wise Watch has this little magnetic charger with, like, two little pogo pins on it. Totally proprietary. And I tend to bump it whenever it's sitting on, like, where, like, if say if I have it sitting by my laptop charging while I'm working, the Wise Watch, I would constantly bump the fucker and it would come off the charger. That didn't happen with the Pixel Watch. So, that's a nice thing. Yeah, the Pixel Watch two-tone leather band is $79. I'm not buying that band. Yeah, I don't want to pay what they want for their accessories. I'll go with the companies making the cheaper ones. A lot of times they're just as good as quality-wise, too. Made in China, but, you know, then what isn't?
Money, money, money.
That's right. And I bought another pair of those Iowa Prodigy Max earbuds from Joe Born. I could, you know, he still has them. They're, like, on eBay for $26. I really liked them, so I bought them. I have a backup pair, so that say I'll run one now, I switch to the other set, and then while the other bud's charging its case, I can still listen, which is kind of nice. Still haven't brought up, you know, I haven't seen very many standalone MP3 players like you like to use, Dan.
They're getting rarer and rarer these days, but I'm still using it.
Sansa still makes a couple.
Well, part of me thought maybe I should just bite the bullet and use my
phone.
Well, I do take my phone with, and my phone's right there all the time. The one thing I don't necessarily like about the MP3 player I have. Shit, I can't remember the name. What is it now?
Sansa Clip?
No, it's not that. They don't, the Sansa Clips.
Oh, you got that one. Oh, I know what you're... It's like a Chinese brand. I can't remember.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So, let me look at my orders. It is the iHumi. So, it's great. It does pretty much everything I want it to do. The only issue I have with it is that the Bluetooth, the range is not very great. And the signal is not, I gotta be very careful with where I put it.
because I find that if anything comes between it and the headset, it can tend to cut out. Like, I can walk up when I work out. If I have to run upstairs and I forget to bring it with me, I can get it. It's spotty getting it up into the kitchen. And so we're only talking like 15, 20 feet away, but we're going, you know, it's not direct line of sight. So it starts to flake out there. But I could even walk across the basement here and start losing signal. If I have it when I'm running, if I have it on my left side,
your body blocks the signal.
Yeah, the receiver's on the right side of my headphones. It has a tendency to block it out too. So it is what it is. And
right.
I don't, you know what? One of the things that I've always... What's the problem? The problem that I find with these new players in the past like 5 or 6 years is the database only supports like 2,000 songs or files.
Yeah, more than that.
Yeah, so if you, so like it's like 32 gigs, right? So in that 32 gigs you could put more than 2,000 songs.
Yep.
But when it goes to index everything, it will only index 2,000 of however many that you have.
Well, that's pretty crappy.
And so, yeah. Now, you can play by just files, but I think, oh gosh, I'm trying to think here. Like, if you... So when you have the option to play by artist or song or just like a random mix of all your songs on there, it's only going to pull the from that 2000 database. Now, I think this one might be a little more. Also, like the original Sansa clip, I think I had... was able to
upgrade storage.
Well, no, it was able to construct a database using both the local storage and an SD card. But none of the devices that I've had since have been able to do that.
It's two separate databases.
Yeah, so if you are going to use local storage, you can generate the database there. But if you go switch it to SD card, it's a whole new database of only what's on the SD card.
Huh.
So, I mean, honestly, I use it 95% of the time to listen to podcasts. Right. So it's not that big of an issue.
Right.
Now, cool. Now, the other thing I really liked about the Sansa Zip was its bookmarking feature that when I would turn off the device, and turn
it would stay on, right there. Right,
it would pick up right where it left off. With this, if I turn the device off,
starts back at the beginning.
The first section is like music, so you click on music, and then the next section is like play.
Right.
Or then the second option is resume, and resume will pick up where you left off. But if you fuck up and press like play, and then it takes you to the list of files and bump it, then you lose where you were before. So,
that sucks.
Also, I think if I'm not mistaken, the clip, this is going back. There was a version of the clip that if you were on a file, like if I was in a podcast, like say 15 minutes in, and I bumped it to the next one, but then I went back to the one I was 15 minutes into, it would pick up again at that 15 minutes. These, all of them since then, have like they'll start just from the beginning.
Dumb bummer.
And they're kind of a pain in the ass to fast forward.
Yep. Yeah, most of them are that way. Even the phone's that way, too. Now, I will say one other thing I did pick up, kind of on a related note, is I picked up a new headset for work because it had like a Anchor Soundcore Q20 set of cans I was using, and that which have a microphone built into it. But because they cover your ears, it just got to be too hot when I was on like a 6-hour call, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I bought some Bone Conduction headphones, the OpenCom model of Shox. So this actually is just like any of their other bone conducting headphones, but has a boom mic on it. So it's a little bit clearer when you're on a Zoom session. Other than the weirdness of, because it doesn't go in your ear, it just kind of rests like right in front of it and then conducts through your bones. That's how you hear it. So you can, the nice thing about them is you can hear all the background noise. But the kind of weird thing is every once in a while you'll feel it. It's not a unpleasant feeling, but you'll feel it vibrating against the side of your head. So, like I said, it's not unpleasant. It's not painful. It's just weird if you never used it before. But other than that, they're super light, super comfortable. And I can wear them for hours. So, and they said they're supposed to, they're right around $159. So it is a little bit pricier than most. It's got noise canceling, so that the good thing is, like, if you have like background noise in your office or something, it helps with that a lot. No complaints from people on Zooms. It has about, it says, an 8-hour battery life, and it comes with a case too, which is kind of nice too. So, like, you throw it in the cable that charges it in the case, so that, and then they all stay together, like, you want to throw it in your backpack or something. So, but they're right, they're $159, Shox, it's Shokz. So, and it came quickly, too. Amazon delivered it literally overnight. What a world we live in. But controls are easy to manipulate when they're on your head, too. It doesn't have, like, some earbuds have, like, touch sensitive controls, which kind of irritate me a little bit. These don't have that. It's got physical buttons on it. So that is really enjoyable. I don't accidentally hit the wrong button or accidentally mute any part of the call or the conversation. So, and I'd like to say how they listen, how they work. I mean, like, general, like, audio. Like, we had a Q1 meeting today, one of those ones where I just had to listen and don't have to talk, you know? It worked fine for that. I've not played music through it. Unless it was just part of the call, like today, had a little music in the call. But yeah, I can't speak for the ones that aren't the OpenCom model, but if they're anything like these, they should be okay. And it's kind of nice, be a great headset for when you're running. That way you can hear the street noise and stuff while you're listening to the music while you run. They are a little pricey, though, so probably not for Dan.
Well, we got to start wrapping this up.
We do.
All right, I'm going to play us out. We'll be back next week.
Yep.
Have a good week, Joe. Hey, anybody? Where are your promos?
I am short.
Oh, my God.
It's Hacker
Public Radio.
Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Hello, my name is Matt, and I've started a new podcast called LibreQuest. I talk about Linux and general technical topics. To get the show, visit LibreQuest.org.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm tired tonight. It's been
tonight. Yeah, my throat is just... Ugh. That's all allergies, man.
Yeah, I was feeling a little bit today myself. Tickle in the throat. A little scratchy.
A little bit of a nasal.
Feel like cold's yep. coming on, but not really.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Say goodnight, Joel. So stop.
Good night, Joel.
Your kids excited? If this is like the last full month of school?
Yeah.
Of course they are, huh? When does school end for you guys?
Well, the colleges are done this week, and then the high schoolers and the middle school are like, they usually go to the end of the month.
End of the month in May, or are you guys like?
Usually they go like first couple days of June, and then they're done.
I think. Well, this week is two of my daughters have finals this week, with college, and my youngest, I believe, goes to June 7th, I think. I know, it's odd, because my wife was just complaining today that, you know, maybe it's June 5th, because she said the last day for students is a Monday, which is really weird. Yeah, doesn't matter to me. I'm still working all summer anyway.
Exactly, all year.
Yeah, all year. That's it. Spring breaks don't matter unless I take off. Spring breaks, summer holidays, winter break.
Same shit, different year.
That's it. Yeah. They don't let us off. Yeah. Got a lot of effort. Ugh. Oh, crap. Oh. All right. Oh, everything's recording. This one's not recording. Why do I keep forgetting that? All right. This is 1003! You know, I thought Link was going to be on.
Yeah, I was about to say. Have you talked to Link anytime recently? I wonder how he's doing.
I mean, I'm assuming he's doing all right, but I haven't talked to him in a while. Oh. I know Alan's doing all right. Well, I'm assuming, unless something changed in the past week and a half, 2 weeks. Got any vacations planned this summer?
nothing major. The band, we were ready to start a lineup gigs.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
When's your first gig?
End of May. There's this out in Pottsville, which is like, you know, bumfuck for hillbilly land. I don't know if you've been over there. They have a motocross, like, monster truck rally thing going on. And then they got bands playing at the end, and we're playing. They're expecting like 3,000 fucking people, man.
Oh, wow. That's going to be something.
I'm going to be nervous as fuck. I've never played in front of that many people before.
There you go. That's going to be great. How many songs? Do you have your set planned out yet?
We're doing 2 sets, 2 hours.
2 hours? Wow. Now, is that in one day? One night?
Yeah.
One
yeah.
night, 2 hours. Yeah. Back to back, or?
A little break in between. Probably like a little 10-minute break in between.
Wow. So you're going to be playing, what, 20?
4 hours.
20.
Like 17 to 20 songs, depending on what songs we play. Like some of the songs are longer, like, you know, like Master of Puppets is like 8 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Revelations is like 7 minutes. Yeah, but most of the songs average, you know, 3 to 4 minutes.
Wow. How many bands are playing?
There's like 2 others, I think. It's a big deal. It's going to be a lot of people there.
Oh, that's cool. Now, do you get a decent cut for that?
$200 probably.
Come on, man. Hey, that beats like doing a bar and getting like $10.
It depends.
No, I guess so, yeah.
Some places are worse than others.
Wow. Pottsville Monster.
Yeah, the singer's really good. He sounds like fucking Rob Halford. We lucked out finding that dude. I thought we were going to be fucking going for friggin' months dragging out trying to find somebody, and we lucked into this dude.
Oh, okay. So that's...
Yeah, so we're doing more like Priest because he does the Priest really good. But uh-huh. we did like Sabbath Dio stuff, and he sounded good doing that stuff too.
So is this the Monster Truck Madness?
I don't know. It's out in the middle of fucking nowhere. It's fucking Pottsville. It's like fucking hillbilly land out there.
Come on, this isn't the right thing. I look for Pottsville. I look for Pottsville.
The 26th, it's a Friday.
Okay, this isn't the right thing. Why?
Yeah, they're going to have a truck bed. That's what we're going to play on.
Wow. May 26th, you said, or 26th?
Yeah, 26th.
Oh, okay. Is this...
Yingling's over there, right?
I'm sorry, what?
Yingling is over there.
Yes.
Yeah, the breweries in that area.
What are the two? What's the other town that sounds like Pottsville?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I thought there was another town that sounded like Pottsville that I sometimes get confused. Okay, here we go.
And then July, we're playing this other show down more towards like Lancaster, Anvil, down over there. And then we're playing at some bar in Allentown, the Jabberjaw. I don't know if you ever heard of that place.
No. In Allentown?
Yeah, that one's in August.
Jabberjaw, that must be, I mean, I don't want to say new, but it must be like in the past decade or so.
I have no idea. I don't go out to bars every weekend, so I don't know these places.
Yeah, because I don't recognize that name, Jabberjaw. I'll have to look that up, see where it is. Why is it so hard to find any of these things? Like, I see dates and stuff, but nothing's on there.
Yeah, we're probably going to do a banned Facebook page. I don't do Facebook, but the other guys are going to do it. They're going to set it up.
Well, that's how you do it.
Okay, Jabberjaw and Allen.
Jabberjaw. Was that a cartoon?
It was. Hanna-Barbera is the shark. It's a name of borrowed.
By the way, Joe sent me a Facebook. He can't make it tonight.
All right. Wow, wow, wow. Okay, why is this thing doing? Come on, focus in. There we go. No. You all right there, Joel?
I am fine.
Sound like Vader.
Yeah, I think I got my allergies.
Oh, yeah, they've been bad this year.
Throat's a little sore. Sinus stuff, too.
Alright, so, wow. Mute yourself, cool.
Okay,
so, Jabberjaw is right down the street from Beachhead Comics. Okay.
Yeah, I've never been to those places.
Yeah, that makes two of them. Well, I've been to Beachhead. I'm surprised Beachhead Comics is still there. That guy was an ass for that. No, not Houston. Oh, in Allentown, Indies. I wonder if he's still the owner.
And now this week my push to talk actually works.
Well, that's a good thing.
Last week it wouldn't. That's weird. Yeah, I got a new smartwatch.
Is it smarter than you?
No. Got the Pixel watch to go along with my Pixel phone.
There you go.
Yeah, the only thing I'm trying to figure out is why Google decided to throw Google Fit out to the curb and use Fitbit. So I guess, well, they own Fitbit, so.
Alright, time to stop screwing around. I'll start the show. 1,003! Oh. With help, man. Oh. I need to really get I need to get that. Right? That's what needs to be done.
Sure. Went old school for our dinner today.
McDonald's?
No, Long John Silver's.
That's shit school, man.
I went to that place once before they closed it down. It was nasty.
Yeah. It varies. They're not what they used to be, but then no place is.
The batter was so thick and tasteless.
Well, the batter tasted fine. It was a little greasier than I'd like, but it was edible. It's one of those things where they had stuff they had back, when I was first, right after we were first married, they used to have these wraps, and those are really good. And the wife and I could buy one and split it between us because they're so big. But definitely not what they were.
I cannot recall the last time I was at a Long John Silver's. I'm going to say it was back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yep.
maybe.
Been that long.
And I think the time before that was back in the 80s. So I think I've only been to Long John Silver's two or three times in my life.
Oh, it was a staple where in our family we went there, I won't say once a week, but we went there a lot. One memory I have of my dad is we went to Long John Silver's for dinner. Dad forgot to fill the gas tank up. We went to go home, and the car wouldn't start because there's no gas. Oh, well.
Well, I take it you weren't too far away from a gas station.
Nah, it was in York when we lived in York.
Now, did you eat in or pick up or what?
At that point, we ate in.
No, I mean today.
Oh, today? No, went through DoorDash.
Oh, let me ask you a question. Like, was that for the whole family?
Yes.
Because honestly, I was like, if you're doing DoorDash, why wouldn't you get something like, I don't know, like pho? I think it's because the rest of your family won't eat that, really.
Well, yeah, and the wife said, well, we could order from multiple places. I'm like, yeah, but it's a pain. It's kind of a pain, not to mention the fact you're paying. Well, if I went through Grubhub, which I don't remember if they were in Grubhub or not, but Grubhub, I get like the plus for free because I have Amazon Prime. So I don't pay any fees for Grubhub.
Okay.
But DoorDash, I like to use DoorDash a little more because they usually have a bigger variety and more local restaurants in them.
Wait, Amazon doesn't own Grubhub now, do they?
I don't think they own it, but I think they get a benefit. You know, they got a benefit deal set up. So you get Grubhub Plus with your Prime Now.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Saves a lot of cash. But then I also found Grubhub. Actually, I haven't used Uber Eats in a long time. But Grubhub or DoorDash are my two go-tos. And at least now, you know, what a world we live in. You know, when I first started working remote, the only damn thing I could get delivered was pizza. And now I can get practically anything. I miss, my son used to bowl in like an afternoon or an evening league. Oh, so there was at least once a week where I was on my own for dinner. So then I'd order whatever I want. So I can get pho, I can get some Indian food, get some butter chicken or something like that. Yeah. Wife's more picky than Luke or I are. You know, I can at least take Luke to a sushi restaurant and get sushi with him. Does he like sushi?
Who doesn't, man? Your wife, right?
Oh, yeah, she...
Has she ever tried it?
She won't. She's just too chicken.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe one day you get her to try something and open up the whole floodgate.
She's just... Well, see, that's actually... Now, one kind of cool thing with her helping Luke out with DoorDash, they see all these different restaurants because they got to go, you know, wherever the app tells them to go to pick up the delivery, right?
Right.
So they had a couple. There's a – I don't know if you got them there. There's a restaurant up here called BB Bop, which is like stir fry – you know, like, so you can get in there and get like a beef teriyaki or something like that. But it's a little bit done like kind of like Subway is where you can say, I want this and that on my stir fry, you know, and they'll do it. So I might got her half talked into that, and they do deliver in the apps, but I think she'd probably want to go in first, into the restaurant first. Because some of the stuff she just doesn't know what it is until she sees it, I guess. They don't even, like, neither one of them has an account in those apps. I'm the one that always has to do that stuff because she doesn't like doing it. In fact, I've had her send me a text message when I'm out of town. And she's like, can you order us blah, 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 and have them bring it to us? And I'm like, yeah, sure.
Oh, I see what Bebop is. We have similar stuff like that.
It's good, yeah. Some of the sides aren't as good, though, in my opinion. But I got their kimchi was it was okay.